Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to examine some aspects of corporate Germany, and in so doing, we're going to be reprising information that veteran and regular listeners have heard before, and supplementing that with information that even the most veteran and most regular listeners have not heard before. Having said that, let's proceed directly with the substantive material of the program. For this first article, we owe a major tip of the hat to a listener who researched this for us. This article is a Reuters story, dateline Frankfurt, Germany, February 7th. It's headlined, Analysis, Fortress Germany's Walls Not Crumbling Yet. What this deals with is an analysis of German corporate policy, in particular as set against the deal that was reached between the Vodafone Company of the United Kingdom, the largest British mobile phone company, and Mannesmann AG, a German firm which was originally involved with heavy industrial production and later branched out into communications. We dealt with the Mannesmann-Vodafone struggle in For the Record Program 187, and we're going to reprise that information and supplement it with more right now. Again, this is a Reuters story, researched for us by a listener. It's headlined, Analysis, Fortress Germany's Walls Not Crumbling Yet. It reads in part as follows. Foreign predators will find it difficult to break into Fortress Germany for some years to come, despite Vodafone AirTouch PLC's successful conquest of Mannesmann. Successful here belongs in quotes for reasons we'll talk about in a second. The British group's three-month battle for Mannesmann AG, the first foreign hostile bid to succeed here, shows how tough it is to buy a German firm that wants to stay independent, bankers said. The two firms slugged it out in a campaign which proved a milestone in German corporate history. Mannesmann's chief executive Klaus Esser, who argued with often bitter rhetoric that his firm would be better off on its own, only gave up 4 days before the bid deadline by agreeing to a deal under improved terms. Note that last statement. It's a deal under improved terms. It really was not so much a hostile takeover as a hostile struggle resolved when Mannesmann, with the aid of many other German corporations, was able to mount enough corporate or capital artillery, so to speak, to oblige Vodafone to what was little more than a 50-50 split. Continuing. Foreign takeovers here remain hard, said Lorenz Albrecht, co-head of Dresdner Kleinwort Benson's German mergers and acquisitions business. Quote, in the end, Vodafone and Mannesmann went the German way, and there was a deal. Had it remained hostile, the process would have been difficult for all concerned. Unquote. Apart from German wariness of what is seen here as the Anglo-Saxon hire and fire culture, there are structural hurdles that look set to prevent an imminent flood of takeovers. Buyers need to obtain at least 75% of voting rights to obtain full control of a German company, because 25.01% is sufficient to veto major decisions. And foreign firms cannot forcibly buy out minority shareholders in a German firm. Quote, there is no squeeze out, unquote, said a senior executive at a U.S. investment bank in Frankfurt who asked not to be named. Again quoting, in Britain, if a company obtains more than 50% of a company, minority shareholders must run for cover. Here, you need a very large stake in a company, otherwise you will just keep getting the red card at shareholder meetings. Unquote. Vodafone's bid met with initial political opposition in Germany. Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, who initially responded to Vodafone's move by saying hostile bids could ruin a firm's corporate culture, quickly fell silent after his comments were criticized throughout Europe as political intervention and even hurt the euro single currency. The stigma attached to hostile mergers was such that German banks refused to handle the exchange of shares on behalf of Vodafone, which was forced to rely on Paribas' German retail operations instead, industry sources said. Recent corporate scandals have shown a continued lack of transparency in German firms. Years of poor supervision can keep buyers in the dark about what they are getting. Skipping down. Large parts of German industry here are almost impossible to buy because they are either in the hands of families or foundations known to be reluctant to sell, or they are state-owned. Dynamic media group Bertelsmann AG, for example, is owned by the Bertelsmann Foundation and the family of Reinhard Mohn, known to be unwilling to sell. And about 50% of the country's banking market is controlled by publicly owned banks fighting tooth and nail with the EU Commission to retain their privileged credit status. We're going to talk about that later in the program. They are not expected to be privatized in the foreseeable future. That's has to get something of an record for or award for understatement, in my opinion. There are a number of things to take note of. We're going to analyze the Vodafone-Mannesmann takeover struggle in greater detail in a minute. However, in the background of corporate Germany, one must always remember the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, about which I've spoken so often. The Bormann Organization is an institution that is well known to veteran listeners and will seem like fantasy to those who are new to the program. I can only explain it very, very briefly. As the Third Reich was preparing to face military defeat, Martin Bormann, Hitler's deputy and the most important figure in the Third Reich, in my opinion, the real genius behind the throne, so to speak, and Bormann was both an organizational and financial genius, set up 750 corporate fronts. These were subsidiaries of the major German corporations, and all of the liquid wealth of the Third Reich, billions upon billions of dollars worth, was then funneled out to these 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries. These 750 corporations not only became powerful corporate entities unto themselves, but exist in a fundamental, albeit sub rosa, relationship with the major elements of corporate Germany that are better known, such as Volkswagen, Siemens, Deutsche Bank, and other institutions. The mechanisms by which these various corporate fronts were set up is described in the definitive book about the Bormann Organization, a book I've spoken about many times in the past, or excerpted many times in the past. That book is called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart Incorporated, copyright 1981. Paul Manning was one of the greatest journalists of the 20th century. He was part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe with Edward R. Murrow. He covered the air war in Western Europe by becoming a waste gunner on a B-17 because aircraft could not carry extra weight if they were going on a combat mission. He was actually credited with shooting down an ME-109. Later, to cover the air war in Japan, he trained as a nose gunner on a B-29 and flew missions into Japan. He was the person who broadcast the surrenders of both Japan and Germany to the American people on the CBS radio network, and then went on after the war to follow his own holy grail, which was the Bormann Organization, and he got a hold of the Operation Safe Haven files from the Treasury Department. That was the U.S. intelligence investigation of the Flight Capital Program, and ultimately wrote the definitive book about that, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and he paid the price for so doing. His professional career was ruined. The book did not get much publicity. The publisher, Lyle Stewart, had his legs broken the week that the book was published. Manning's professional reputation was destroyed. The family was never even able to own their own home as a result of that. And ultimately, Jerry Manning, his son, was murdered in order to, in retribution not only for this book, but also to see to it that Manning did not publish a follow-up to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which he was planning to do. It is one of the privileges that I enjoy, if that's the word, to be able to carry on to a certain extent, or at least to shed light on Paul Manning's work. Having said that, we're going to take a look at the Bormann Flight Capital Program ever so briefly by way of coming to understand corporate Germany. First of all, Operation Aktion Adlerflug, or Operation Eagle's Flight, as the Germans called the Bormann Flight Capital Program, is discussed in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, as follows. Now, note in the article that I just read, it referred to many German corporate entities as being held by either families or, quote, foundations. In other words, they're in private hands, and as a result, they are not easily taken over. Those, quote, foundations, unquote, are really the holders of the bearer bonds who control the Bormann capital entities, and also, through those, corporate Germany itself. Turning now to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, about some of the structure of the Bormann Group, which underlies corporate Germany, we read, "The movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well," Bormann noted from his reports. Flight capital investments had been accompanied principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. A holding company may not trade in any form. It may hold only stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the, quote, neutrals, unquote, of Europe and to the countries of South America. A control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. Bearer shares require no registration of identity, for such shares are exactly what they mean. The bearer of the majority shares controls the company without needing a vestige of proof as to how he acquired them. Thus, the Germans who participated as a silent force in Bormann's post-war commercial campaign, which is sometimes referred to by aging Nazis as Operation Eagle's Flight or Aktion Adlerflug, ensured their command over the industrial and financial institutions that were to move the new Federal Republic of Germany back into the forefront of world economic leadership. Some of the mechanisms through which the corporate cloaking was accomplished are also described by Paul Manning in his book as follows. In the final days of any war, grabbing and looting are commonplace. Martin Bormann, however, was wrapped up in the dispersal of several billion dollars in assets around the globe. I would note that's several billions of dollars in 1940s dollars. It is many, many, many times that today. Continuing, Bormann dwelled on control of the 750 corporations. He had utilized every known legal device to disguise their ownership and their patterns of operation, use of nominees, option agreements, pool agreements, endorsements in blank, escrow deposits, pledges, collateral loans, rights of first refusal, management contracts, service contracts, patent agreements, cartels, and withholding procedures. Detailed documents and other papers on each company and all money transferred from the Third Reich to outside subsidiaries of the German corporations participating in the flight capital program had been maintained. As goals were achieved, the papers were deposited in Swiss banks. A copy of everything, including field reports, went to Bormann as part of the historic file that would be crated and trucked out of Berlin to Munich, flown to Spain, and then transshipped to the Bormann archives in South America. And the end result of this, in terms of the Bormann Group's control over corporate Germany, is described in a passage I've read many times before. By way of review, I will repeat that passage. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, Bormann is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, parenthetically the former head of the Gestapo, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Skipping down, what will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. Quote, all orders come from the shareholders in South America, unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And ultimately, the Bormann Group is the dominant entity behind the Mannesmann firm, and as we proceed to review the postal takeover struggle between Vodafone and Mannesmann, one should remember Mannesmann's relationship to the Bormann organization. Speaking of the Bormann flight capital into Sweden, bear in mind that the Bormann corporations were set up in neutral countries, Manning writes, members of the German steel cartel, such as Vereinigte Stahlwerke, of which IG Farben's Hermann Schmitz was a director, Mannesmann AG, Krupp, Gute Hoffnungsschütte, and Stahlunion, all owned related enterprises in Sweden, and the importation, handling, and transportation of coal and coke became almost a projection of Germany's coal industry. And still later, of the Bormann flight capital program in Latin America, we read, quoting from a U.S. Treasury Department report, in the field of drugs and pharmaceuticals, the Bayer, Merck, and Schering companies enjoyed a virtual monopoly. IG Farben subsidiaries had a firm hold on the dye and chemical market. German companies such as Tubos Mannesmann, Ferro Stahl AEG, and Siemens Schuckert played a dominant role in the construction, electrical, and engineering fields. And skipping down of the Bormann flight capital program to Latin America, part of the new corporate move to Latin America was represented by Fritz Mondel, capital M-A-N-D-L, the armament manufacturer of the Ruhr, who invested heavily in an Argentine government program to expand its armaments industry. The two largest German firms, ThyssenKrupp SA, Industrial y Mercantil, and La Sociedad Tubos Mannesmann received German financing under the capital made available for export by Martin Bormann. So do remember the Bormann connection not only to corporate Germany, as one analyzes that article from Reuters of February 7th with which I began the program, and as you listen to some of the aspects of the struggle between Mannesmann and Vodafone, bear in mind not only the Bormann group, but take note in particular of how the struggle was waged with various German companies coming to the aid of Mannesmann. As I've noted in past programs, the Third Reich did not disappear, it went underground, and one of the unique features of corporate Germany is that all German corporations and all major German financial institutions operate in concert as vehicles of national interest and of international conquest. This contrasts sharply with the corporate policies of other countries, which basically are entities or are vectors unto themselves. The corporations act as profit-making institutions responsible only to their boards of directors and shareholders. They do not operate in any sort of with any sort of national agenda, and certainly not as vehicles for conquest. That contrasts markedly with the German corporations as agents of the Bormann Group and the Underground Reich, as I have described it. As Mannesmann, before the Mannesmann-Vodafone struggle took place, Mannesmann, like Deutsche Telekom, had been purchasing major mobile phone companies in the United Kingdom, among other places, and just like major German corporate takeovers in the United States, have remained unopposed by American political figures and even the heads of various corporations that were taken over, so the British corporations that were bought out by Mannesmann and Deutsche Telekom offered no resistance, and this contrasts sharply with the German in response to the Vodafone bid for Mannesmann. Reading now from the Financial Times of Friday, October 22nd of 1999, we read, "Bold move hits Mannesmann shares." Subtitled, "There is a price to pay to become Europe's biggest mobile phone operator," write Ralph Atkins and Peter Tall Larson. The article reads in part, "Mannesmann's audacious acquisition of Orange, the UK's third largest mobile operator, left investors gasping yesterday, but shares in the Dusseldorf-based group fell 13 euros to 144.8 euros on concerns about the price and its increased debt." Skipping down, speaking of Mr. Esser. "And Mr. Esser stood aside as Deutsche Telekom bought one-to-one the UK's fourth-largest mobile network, knowing that Mannesmann had a good chance of winning the bigger prize of Orange." And that alludes to the fact that both Deutsche Telekom and Mannesmann were purchasing major British mobile phone companies. Notice that there was no opposition from the British political leadership or from British corporate leadership to that takeover. That, however, contrasts very, very sharply with the attempted takeover of Mannesmann by Vodafone. Reviewing some articles that we dealt with in For the Record Program 187, this one from the Financial Times of London of November 20th and November 21st of 1999. This is also an article by Peter Tall Larson and Ralph Atkins in Dusseldorf, and also Haig Simonian in Berlin and Alan Crane. It's entitled, "German Chancellor Weighs Into Battle Over Mannesmann," subtitled, "Schroeder Leads Defense with Comments Against Hostile Bids. Vodafone Finally Unveils $123 Billion Improved Offer." The article reads in part as follows. Gerhard Schroeder, the German chancellor, yesterday intervened in the €120 billion or $123.6 billion takeover battle between Vodafone, Airtouch, and Mannesmann, declaring that hostile bids destroyed the, quote, culture, unquote, of the target company. In an implicit warning to Vodafone, Mr. Schroeder said hostile bidders in German companies, quote, underestimate the virtue of co-determination, unquote, workers' representation in the boardroom. What he should have said is they underestimate the Bormann participation in German corporations. Skipping down. Yesterday, Mr. Gent noted that German companies, including Deutsche Telekom's purchase of One-to-One and Mannesmann's purchase of Orange, had been allowed to take control of British mobile phone companies. Quote, I had hoped for Schroeder to emphasize this for shareholders, that this is for shareholders to decide. Unquote. So again, note the German political leadership intervening on behalf of Mannesmann. The German finance minister as well, Hans Eichel, also intervened. This from the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, November 23rd of 1999. This is an article by Ralph Atkins and Haig Simonian in Berlin. It's headlined, Germany Calls for New Rules to Govern European Takeovers. Subtitled, Finance Minister Seeks to Avoid Economic Culture Clash. Country's biggest building company collapses. And note again, when German corporations were buying out other companies' corporations, their political leadership and the corporate leadership of the target companies did not respond the way the Germans did. This article reads, in part, Hans Eichel, Germany's finance minister, yesterday called for new takeover rules in Europe to avoid a culture clash between Anglo-American capitalism and the consensual German model. His comments follow Vodafone AirTouch's record $124 billion or $128 billion, €124 billion or $128 billion hostile bid for Mannesmann, which has alarmed Germany's political establishment on the right and the left, and also I would say with the shareholders in Latin America, something that doesn't get discussed. Now, what we're going to do next is to analyze some of the goings-on during the course of the struggle between Mannesmann and Vodafone. One of the things to note here is how not only did the German corporations, like the German political leadership, close ranks behind Mannesmann, but they also began engaging in various kinds of machinations in order to drive up the corporate value of Mannesmann, thereby frustrating or certainly making more difficult the takeover bid by Vodafone. This is from the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, January 20th of the year 2000. This is an article by Ralph Atkins in Berlin, and it's headlined, Domestic Banks Back Mannesmann, and it reads in part as follows. Germany's main banks are backing Mannesmann, the German telecommunications group, in its takeover battle with the UK's Vodafone AirTouch to advice given to retail investors in high street branches. And again, note the way the German banks closed ranks behind Mannesmann. And German corporations as well, or corporations that had capital participation by German firms, also were engaged in various key strategic negotiations with Mannesmann. Those negotiations drove up the potential takeover value of Mannesmann, thereby making it more difficult for Vodafone to take over. And as we saw in that article from Reuters of February 7th, ultimately this increase in the value of the Mannesmann firm helped to force a much more, quote, consensual, unquote, settlement. Basically, a 49.9 to 50.1 settlement. Much different than the original hostile takeover bid. Interestingly, one of the companies involved in some of the negotiations was AOL, America Online. AOL Europe is a joint AOL Bertelsmann operation. Bertelsmann, recall in the February 7th article from Reuters, is one of those companies in private hands, and as we have seen in numerous programs about German corporate control over American publishing, there are strong and obvious links between Bertelsmann and the Underground Reich. For references on those, I refer interested listeners to For the Record programs 122, 123, 152, 177, 189, and 194 that discuss various aspects of some of those links. And also, as discussed in 194, there was significant capital participation by Bertelsmann in AOL, and even though that ultimately is going to be sold, some of it has already been sold, AOL is going to remain a partner with Bertelsmann in AOL Europe. And note that it was the AOL and AOL Europe connection and the Bertelsmann connection to it that potentially made a Mannesmann deal with AOL possible, and which ultimately would have driven up the value of Mannesmann. Reading now from the Financial Times of January 22nd and January 23rd of the year 2000, this is an article by Carolyn Daniel and Richard Rivlin and James Harding. It's headlined, Mannesmann and AOL Hold Talks Over Link. It's subtitled, Online Services and Discussions Could Lead to U.S. Internet Giants Supplying Content Over German Groups' Mobile Phones. This article reads in part as follows. Mannesmann, the German telecommunications group seeking to fend off a hostile bid from Vodafone AirTouch of the UK, has been in contact with America Online about developing a loose link. The discussions, still at an early stage, could lead to an agreement to deliver content from AOL, the U.S. Internet giant, over Mannesmann's mobile phone networks. But advisors say any potential partnership is, quote, not a deal-maker or deal-breaker, unquote, in the Mannesmann-Vodafone takeover bid. Skipping down, one person familiar with the situation said, quote, there is logic in AOL having an interest in it. It is about validating Monisman's defense strategy and valuation, unquote. AOL Europe, the joint venture between AOL and Bertelsmann, reaches 2.8 million households across Europe. The contact with AOL is one of a number of forays by Monisman, which has also had discussions with Vivendi, parenthetically a French firm, about deepening its participation in the French mobile phone market. Ultimately, it was Vodafone that worked out the agreement with Vivendi, thereby frustrating that aspect of the Monisman negotiations. More about the Monisman-AOL negotiations from the Financial Times of London of Friday, January 28th of the year 2000. This is an article by Peter Tall Larson and Ralph Atkins in Berlin. It's headlined, Monisman opens discussions to take stake in AOL Europe. It reads in part as follows. Monisman, the German mobile phone group, is in talks about taking an equity stake in AOL Europe, the internet service provider. Monisman, which is attempting to fight off a $158 billion, notice how the bid keeps increasing here. It was originally something like 120-something euros. I have to go back and look at that article. Now it's up to 158 billion euros, or $156.42 billion. Notice this increase, because that's what all of this corporate maneuvering is about. Monisman, which is attempting to fight off a 158 billion euro or $156.42 billion hostile bid from Vodafone AirTouch of the UK, has been holding discussions with AOL Europe's shareholders about a possible deal. America Online, the U.S. internet group, and Bertelsmann, the German media group, each own 50% of AOL Europe. Skipping down. Negotiations over AOL Europe have been held up because of the complexity of a potential deal. If Monisman were to take a stake in the company, it is unclear whether AOL or Bertelsmann or both would reduce their proportionate holding in the internet group. And again, note how this maneuvering increased the value of the takeover bid from 120-odd to 150-odd billion-dollar euros, a billion euros. We're going to continue not only with analysis of the Monisman-Vodafone struggle, but we're also going to take a look at a very heavy-handed and apparently successful German effort to have a German, and in fact a German with joint Brazilian and German citizenship, appointed head of the IMF. When one sees joint German and Brazilian citizenship, a knowledgeable listener should automatically think of the Bormann Group. I've alluded to some of the For the Record programs. Those programs and other tapes that I've produced over the years are available from a tape duplication service. The name of that service is Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. It's located at P.O. Box 1179. That's Post Office Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. Once again, spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That website is also equipped with real audio so that listeners can hear the tapes going out to the various stations that carry this program the week that they are going out. There was also a matching list on the KFJC website. KFJC-FM in the South San Francisco Bay Area is my home base station. And on the KFJC website at kfjc.org, you can look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section for the Spitfire list. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. Note that listeners can listen to the weekly show that I do on KFJC between 7 and 10 p.m. Pacific Time and 6 to 7 p.m. That's 7 to 10 p.m. Sunday and 6 to 7 p.m. on Thursday Pacific Standard Time. That, once again, is at kfjc.org. That concludes this half hour. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.